I want to deal with an issue that you're all familiar with from your own reading and discussions that is almost passe, but I think it's worth our discussing, and that is a worship place a place for the household of God, or is it a place that is God's place? That can be stated in many different ways. And along with this, we're going to deal very briefly with some things that buildings tend to say to people, more in terms of what just some general mechanisms are of buildings making statements to people. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on that. That could be a long, long discussion of its own. But it's pointed. We want to point in the direction, I guess, of saying: Do our buildings associated with churches say the appropriate things to people? And we want to talk about that toward the end of the discussion, and perhaps at that point also deal once again with the current question of: I want to find out where heaven is. And I may ask for you to, at the end of this period, to volunteer some answers. I'll be really disappointed if I leave Holden without knowing where heaven is, because this, after all, is close to heaven, and there should be more knowledge about that here than many places. Let's see. I think we can probably leave on the lights the way they are. And as we talked about last time, just a quick review, we talked about light. Light is used to describe form and is part of our being. And in fact, space and light are two entities that kind of go along together, because we have to have light to, of course, see spaces. And we talked about the fact that light articulates form, in exterior, interior form. We have seen how light has been used in some ways to represent kind of a mysteriousness quality that is often almost inseparable with what we call religious spaces, and that's something that we need to keep thinking about continually. Some light uses that you were just referring to, Ed, are used purposefully, I think, in the past to say this is kind of religious light. And I am wondering more and more if we have been maybe too casual about that. We'll talk about a little bit about shrineism tomorrow at the time that I'm presenting things. I think a space like this, like the MIT chapel, perhaps is a wonderful place to do private meditation and to kind of go into oneself and think about a lot of internal thoughts. But I'm not sure that could ever be today a really good worship space. So the thesis, in a part, is that if we look at some of these spaces that purposefully have picked up on being so-called religious spaces, and we have seen spaces that we know could be used by religious groups very effectively that aren't necessarily so-called religious spaces, like Hamlet's Castle or the Grand Ballroom in Seattle, this one, or a recital hall such as this nice one at St. Olaf College, which is used by weddings, etc. And we've seen spaces such as this one that has a magical, mysterious quality to it, which in fact has no religiosity about it that you can point to, except what different religious groups have added to it over the centuries. almost like commercial architecture. You have a, can somebody hit that machine and see if they could get it, keep it from squeaking? You know, almost like a secular building that you put up a new sign on the front when it changes from, you know, a furniture store to a A&P or to a hardware store. Here is almost a neutral space that is magnificently designed for different religious groups to use it. Now, if God is present in the world, can we really limit God's power by saying God is more present in so-called religious buildings than elsewhere? And I think we have no problem with this kind of question in most of our religious circles today. We would not say, would we, that God is more present in church than in a bowling alley or on a street corner. Although I'm suggesting in this talk, in these series of talks, that oftentimes the way we speak and the unspoken language in worship and our church buildings seem to suggest that, without any doubt. And I think maybe we can go back a little bit to begin with and just say, well, how did we get to this point? Where does this come from? And it comes really from the Gothic times, because we're in America, I think, pretty much stuck on a Gothic imagery from the Middle Ages that was adopted in the 19th century all over America as being kind of the best way to do things for churches, and also the way to do things in small towns. Where Jennifer and I live in Northfield, we have arched elm trees over the streets that were planted that way to make them look like Gothic arches. And we live in houses that were built at a time when the right way to live was kind of based on single-family houses of purity and simplicity, and it came out of that same time. And so we have the Gothic model in America that's very, very present in so many ways. Now, if we go back and say, well, before we talk about space and some more interesting things of a practical nature, we might go back and say, well, let's go back to square one. What does the Bible say about architecture? What did Jesus say about worship spaces? What did he say?
The body is the temple of God.
Where two or more are gathered in my name. Is there, as in the Old Testament, is there somewhere a little write-up that says a worship space should still be so many cubits wide, cubits long, and cubits high? There shall be a narthex and a nave and a chancel. In fact, I think there are many references in the Bible to kind of staying away from the temple as a place. There was a certain rejection of the status quo. Not so much the synagogue, because that was a place of education. But temple-like structures were kind of shunned, in a sense. People met where? With Jesus.
On boats. By the sides of the water. Mm-hmm.
Pretty worldly places, right? Mm-hmm. Just wherever people were, mm-hmm. basically. Okay. It's so obvious, right? Mm-hmm. This is Solomon's temple, which was a model that was there, and that was not picked up on as a place to worship in, because it was there. But what we might talk about is the home. And the home model for the church has been around for maybe 20 years now as a rediscovered entity. And it is worth going back and looking at it a little bit. And the way I'll introduce this is that most of the settlements in the Roman world, when the church expanded in the Roman world were Palestinian type of villages that we're familiar with looking at, and I forgot to take some pictures of, just for illustrations, but also of Roman towns. And these towns were laid out as little colony settlements. They are where we get our grid system in American cities and in the Midwest from about the 5th century BC. There was a certain process where a knowledgeable person would go out on the land and do the right spells and say the right things and take the right signs from the stars and from the position of the moon and lay out along the exact compass directions, north, south, east, west, a town. And their towns looked kind of like these. They were walled cities, frequently expandable. Frequently they would lay out a, maybe a larger area that they expected it to be populated to eventually, and then would settle in the middle first. There was always a main road that went east and west, which I believe is called the Ordo. Another main road, a place was given for the forum, circus, where the wells would be, where people would gather for public meetings, the baths, place for livestock. And then each one of these little blocks was like a city block in our thinking that might be broken down like this into small units where people would have houses. You can kind of see by the pattern that runs horizontally here where there are walls that are dividing different houses. And in yellow, I've outlined where somebody's got a bigger house and somebody's got a smaller house, depending upon their status or whether they were, I suppose, military people or merchants or new settlers. And this is jumping now to a model of such a Roman house actually in Pompeii. A small middle-class house would be something like this, a courtyard, a place you come in off the street, walls all the way around the thing for protection and for the ability of these houses to be closely packed together. There'd be a room right off the outside where maybe some animals would be kept, a dining room, a kitchen over on the far left, a dining space, a place maybe for a downstairs kind of living. They usually had stairways in them and had a second story. In the center was a courtyard where sun came in. In some cases there was a sloped roof that went to the center of the courtyard and water drained down and filled up a cistern because it was really dry country. And there in fact was a baptismal font suggested by the fact that there was a pool, perhaps, or at least a cistern in that courtyard. This is an example that's been reconstructed of some middle-class Pompeian Roman houses from about the 2nd century. Some of the whitewashing is falling off, but you can see that these looked like pretty good urban city houses. If you had more money, you might have a, like the surgeon in Pompeii, you might have a swimming pool, some bigger rooms. And in fact, what likely the church did is the church gathered more members from time to time, or as things went on, it might go from one size house to the next, depending upon the size of that congregation, because the church met in houses. And in a way, the liturgy and the practices we have probably initiated from the fact that to some degree people would maybe gather and talk, like for the introduction of the service or the before the catechumen, so to speak, would all gather together for the common meal, the Eucharist, maybe in the courtyard, maybe in one of the spaces, and then they would maybe move into the dining room for the very special kind of communion parts of a service. Now, when the Christian community got big enough that it really couldn't be housed in a house very easily, and when it became less persecuted and was publicly accepted, then the problem of the church building really came up. And you all know this story, that the basilica was the model floating around because it was there. That was the meeting hall. The public meeting hall in a Roman town was called the basilica. Here's a reconstruction of a Roman settlement, actually before the time of Christ, in England, in the British Isles. And they've reconstructed the way in which the forum at the center of town and the shops and everything were the place for the minister of justice to be, were organized along the same courtyard where the large building at the back was the public meeting room called the basilica. They looked like this as they were translated into the prime spaces for the church. A rather long, but not real long, space that had columns on each side, an apse at the end, in this case a courtyard off the side. This is a model constructed of what the first version of St. Peter's in Rome was thought to be like from the archaeology they had done. It was a basilica, a little bit bigger one than perhaps normal because it was in Rome with a forecourt. Then you went into the main hall. Looking at that in section and plan, it was like this. It happened to have two aisles on each side because it was a major church building at that time in 333. And as the church became much more imperial oriented and hierarchically organized, the churches began, the basilica form began to broaden in width and began to get longer. And the very end of the basilica, where the apse was, became the place of the bishop eventually, just as that was where Roman justice was administered from the end of that long room. Here's a model of the Church of the Nativity from the year about 350, I believe, that was built in Bethlehem in remembrance of Jesus' birth, which was a basilica form with a very large kind of chapel at the end, a move toward making the church even longer than initially was the practice. Here's a very complete example of a basilica from about 450 in Rome, in which we can see the basic ingredients of kind of the prototype that developed into the Gothic model of the church. We have light coming from above. We've got a tall space. In this case, there's actually light coming through the wall at the apse, which was true of the secular basilicas because they wanted light to be on the walls on the inside. And some say that as these basilicas became bigger and bigger, they tended to have fewer and fewer windows on the side aisles, which were actually there initially, so that this illusion of darkness near the earth and light coming in from above was accentuated. And the access became accentuated as the church kind of grew in power. That's kind of the geometric history of this church form. As the church became publicly stronger and more associated with the state, of course it became more powerful, more wealthy. You'll find some basilica forms that have the beginnings of transepts. They became more embellished with artwork to, in a sense, tell stories inside the space and make the history of the church and the stories of the church much more evident. But there was also a move at the same time toward what we call, in the arts, I guess, a kind of dematerialization of the fact of this building, the presence of this mass. People were interested in light. They were interested in spiritual matters, not in the earthiness of the building itself. So in fact, things were done to the columns, to the walls, etc., to make them more transparent. In the case of the Gothic, in the terms of the late Romanesque, of letting the stories and the imagery kind of float in the space. So you really weren't aware of the architecture so much. You were transformed by the kind of magical interior that was there. There, of course, were the Mavericks who said, let's get back to basics and let's have round churches or churches that are more familial. One of these built in at the very same time in Rome was of this nature, where people gathered in a circular fashion. I think it's perfectly clear the way that this altar dominates that circular form, that there really wasn't a whole lot of space for participation, except to kind of honor the altar at the center of things. Another example of the basilica, for those of you who travel, can be seen today in Trier, Germany. This was a basilica built as part of a Roman town, which Trier is in Germany, and the governor and his family had a complex, and they had a basilica as part of that complex that was their grand ballroom and where they had public affairs, and it was kind of their party room. And when they became converted to Christianity, they gave that space to the church. So since the 4th century, this space, this original basilica, has been in use by Christians as a church. So it's a very authentic basilica form in that sense, and interesting to look at. And you can see here that it's early enough that there's lots of light bathing the space, but not a big point has been made at this time yet in this real verticality of the space. And over the years, and kind of the modernization of the space, actually all the imagery that was painted on the walls between probably the 5th century and the 12th century was cleaned out of here. And certainly at the Reformation that would have been done, right? More of the same. So that all grew into the Gothic, where this was played even stronger to, in fact, deal with the perfection of the spiritual life. Cathedrals were designed mathematically based on circles and squares and number theory of the time. It was one of the philosophical and mathematical issues of the day, is how do you achieve perfection through building, and the use of color and the proportions of windows and all of that. And the way columns were defined as small bundles of small columns that raised up to the roof carried out this theme of kind of denying, in a sense, the material quality of the building. And very beautifully, very dramatically saying that there's another point to these buildings besides showing you how the roof stands up in the air, because the question here is heaven and the afterlife. Magnificent spaces, just undeniably beautiful spaces. But the problem we've inherited, of course, is the plan, as well as that theology. And that's one of our points here in this talk. We, as architects these days, like to refer to the medieval plan as the bus church. Okay, right? You're seated in a Gothic cathedral as if you're on the bus traveling somewhere. And that's a good analogy, because in fact you were in effect supposedly transported to another land. You were on a journey. You in fact were to believe that this trip goes on and on forever, and this is just the start of a life of faith and a journey to the beyond. The interest was not in the community assembled and being together. So in large and small, we've inherited, as you all know very well, the kind of the Gothic imagery of the church, which we are dealing with in this century all the time, because we love a lot of the beautiful aspects of Gothic architecture. It's magnificent, but the struggle is, in so many ways, it doesn't represent what we believe anymore. There are interesting churches that have been built all over in the Gothic image that we can enjoy and love for what they are. Many of you have visited this one, I'm sure, that I like to show. It was built after World War II in Copenhagen, Grundtvig Church, by school children contributing pennies and to buy each brick one at a time. Churches such as Saarinen's prophetic, prototypical church in Indiana is a Gothic church built out of modern materials. The issue here was how you build a modern materialed church. It's not necessarily a modern liturgical church. We'll talk more about this later, but one of the parallel issues has been, well, in our era, what kind of Christian symbolism should there be in the church if we don't deal with the Gothic imagery anymore in the way that Gothic people did? And you've seen probably examples all over of churches that are very expressive, because it kind of architects get out of control with churches. They think that's kind of the blank check to have a lot of fun with other people's money sometimes. And this is the famous Fish Church in Stamford, Connecticut. You can see the fin, the tail fin here, and then it comes out the sides. And if you're flying over in a 747 or whatever, you can see a fish on the ground. That's out of place. The Grundtvig Church again. And of course, Gothic floor plans, this is Salisbury Cathedral actually, were very elongated, very elaborate. The linear trip through these buildings was very clear in plan. Now, what I'd like to go into, in contrast to the problem of the Gothic church imagery you have in America, is the way in America we have thought about space. I know I'm trying to cover too many things this afternoon, but we'll just rush through these. And I like these old Currier Knive calendar drawings, because they in some ways represent to me the idea that in the new land there was plenty of space. It was heaven on earth to imagine the cottage in the countryside where everyone had a peaceable piece of the action. You had your own orchard, you had your own animals, there was nobody around to bother you, there wasn't any traffic, there wasn't any pollution. And this was celebrated, especially in the 19th century, as the land was populated, even earlier, of course, but it was mostly celebrated then. If there were too many people in America, what did you do? You get up and you went west, right? If you just got more space. And we've been space hogs because of, in a sense, a couple centuries of this idea that there's lots of it and we can move along if something irritates us. And here's in the springtime out in the country. Now, the interesting thing about, I think, American concepts of space is that we've always kind of been able to, as in a kind of an aside, we've always been able to figure out a way to move on, kind of dump what is a problem, and you can move away from a problem that you have. And this is a small point I'm making, because it relates to the problem we now have of managing our environment and managing old buildings, because we're used to kind of simply leaving our trash behind us and going somewhere else and doing something. But we're having to revise our ideas of space all the time. And this is affecting, I think, our work with the church design a great deal. And one of the things that we might learn from some of these slides, I would hope, is that, especially when we deal with building spaces, is if we again try to learn some of the syntax of this language of form, it may help us in this revision process we have to go through at many levels. And I'd like to start by simply saying that in terms of definitions about architectural spaces, we know what those are because we all occupy space ourselves. So in terms of a simple perception of space, it's that volume of air or water that our bodies displace, and here we are. Or in terms of, I suppose, kinesthetic space, when we talk about movement, people and buildings and sculpture, such as the servant here, in a sense, occupy space. And architecturally, we usually think about two kinds: an interior space, where, in fact, some kind of a shell or form draws a line between the outside and some kind of inside. Buildings also very effectively will make a statement about the outside at the same time that they're making a statement about the inside. I have a few examples here of that. This happens to be in England, St. Paul's. So at the same time, a complex building is really doing two things at one time. It's making an external statement, in a sense making space around it, at the same time that it's making an internal space. And they're kind of different sides of the same coin in terms of the formal way of discussing these kinds of issues. Usually we like buildings that kind of give us a hint on the outside of what's going to happen on the inside. Even a complex of buildings like Mont Saint Michael in France, built out on an island, in a way it makes a space on a landscape by just its presence, and it, as well as being kind of a landmark and something that attracts the eye. This famous chapel in, which I think is St. Nicholas, is that right? I forgot the name of this. Jennifer, do you remember the name of this one? In the Kremlin. Beautiful little piece of Eastern Christianity within the walls of the Kremlin. Makes a wonderful statement, you know, in that space because of its form. If you look at a cross-section of that building, it's simultaneously using those same elements, the same shape of the outside, the columns, the domes that you see on the outside, to make the reverse of that space on the inside. Even in the basement, where those columns go down through to the ground and are locked into the earth, and the floors are arched to support the weight of the people in them, a space is being made that's an internal space that has a wonderful unity throughout the building because the type of construction is so elemental and so understandable. Now, one thing that interests a lot of us in this syntax of making space is that the actual wall that separates the outside world from the inside world gets to be of great importance. I think it was Scott that made a reference about the nature of this wall system in Elsinore. And here again, the way a wall is articulated is of great interest to all of us because it makes a clear-cut statement about the degree of protection you have, the degree of openness, the way you are aware of the environment outside, the way light comes in. And if you spend a few moments considering all of the jobs that a wall has to do, or even a roof, it's really quite an amazing invention and device with a lot weighing on its performance. because, of course, we've got to deal with issues of mediating temperature. It's, again, the analogy to our clothing. We use spaces to moderate our local climate so that it's comfortable inside, no matter what the weather is like outside. That device is also supposed to shed water so that the rain doesn't come through it. It's supposed to do that in a way that doesn't melt or begin to deteriorate. It is a device that sometimes you want to have keep out sounds. It is a device that has many qualities, depending upon the climate you're in, that deal with our comfort. You have parts of it that open up for air to blow through. You have parts of it that open up so people can walk in and out, or pets or animals, depending upon or machinery, depending upon the kind of space it is. And all of these pieces have to fit together in a wall at the same time that it's making a clear symbolic architectural statement that on one side of it is inside, is a different kind of space than the outside. And that's the kind of the theoretical stuff of architecture, is thinking very carefully about the way walls work and how they are apprehended by our senses, or how the spaces are really dealt with at the same time. For instance, in this location, we talked about the event of walking into a window space and being able to look outside at the same time that you're inside the building. An intriguing aspect of wall design to many people these days especially is that an old castle space like this, when you are actually going out to look at a window, you for a time are inside the wall itself. You're kind of in a very interesting zone when you are inside the wall of a building. We call these, in design language, in-between spaces. They're ambiguous spaces. They're not clear-cut, but they're locations in architecture where I think the senses are enlivened and become more attuned to the environment itself. Some other examples, which I don't have slides of, I don't believe. I might give to you. Here, first, we could suggest that in an imperial reception room in Japan, where the architecture has very thin walls because of the climate and everywhere, by going through a line of posts, or by having fabric and posts defining wall conditions, you can deal with the same issues of defining that once you're in here, you're in a very important space. It's kind of shutting out the outside world. Very distinct space compared to the exterior. In this famous abbey at Sanac in southern France, the penetration of that little window in the wall, the light coming in, the fatness of the walls that you can see in those little side apses are intriguing. You want to go and explore those things because you are can participate in a very strange, ambiguous part of the building. In some ways, it's more fun in cathedrals to walk down the side aisles than it is to be right out in the middle, because you're within some of the structure, you're within the wall thickness, etc. And one of the illustrations of that in-between effect that, I'm not sure there are any examples around here, but how many of you enjoy sitting in bay windows? Just think of the qualities of a bay window. Okay. Here's a little bump in a space that brings you outside of the structure, the main part of the structure. When you're out in a bay window, you can in fact kind of turn around and you can look at the outside of the wall that is on the outside of the space that you're in. Very strange ability to be able to do that. You can be kind of in two places at once. You can be inside and the outside. You could also participate in the view and panorama and things of that sort on the outside of the building with all the protection of being in the inside. It's a simple example of an in-between space that's really an exciting kind of architectural space. You think about in-between spaces. I've picked up a lot of clues over the years from watching animals. If you've ever watched the way a cat finds places to sit or curl up in a house, provokes you to think that, boy, it would be really nice to find some of those same places and be able to sit on them yourself, because they're places where the animal can maybe gain some heat from a window and watch what's going on in a room, or be in a doorway between two spaces. There might be an air current there. It might be a place where that cat can, or the animal can, kind of patrol both domains, you know, can kind of look at both rooms at the same time. So some of those ingredients and spaces that we find really, really interesting to work with are founded in just the notions of a wall is an architectural device that separates the outside from the inside, and by promoting and thinking very carefully about wall and the shape that provides inside, we end up with interesting architectural spaces. Another, I suppose, easy example to think about is the what entrances do in spaces. And one of the difficulties we have, I think, in modern design is not knowing how to deal with entrances very well. We think of those entirely in functional terms, but sometimes we don't even think of them entirely in functional terms. For instance, coming into Koinonia, there's an entrance problem, right? You have basically a very simple shed-like industrial building with a door in it. And then you add things to it to make it work. Just in terms of functioning, you add a little rain cover on the outside so that when you stop to open the door, there isn't rain in your ears. You know. And then you make a stone area that you can stand on, terra firma, when you're about ready to go into the door. We have these problems everywhere. I'm not trying to just pick on this building, but it's a good illustration that you can think about as you go in and out of this building. As soon as you're in the building, you have to have a place usually where you orientate yourself. You might knock the stuff off your feet. In this case, there's a problem with snow in the wintertime and dirt in the summer and sawdust right now, which is getting all up and down the stairs. So one of the interesting architectural devices, both in functional terms of dealing with the fact that there's such a change when you go from the outside world into the inside world, but also to deal symbolically with what is this trip, what is this kinetic experience of going from the outside to the inside, that for centuries entrances have been made into a big deal. This little portal, the size of a person for that church in Russia at the Kremlin, you can see is enlarged and embellished in multiple ways so that you know where the door is, and you feel like you're really celebrating the fact that you're going into the interiors of the space. Cathedrals, of course, use the same motifs. Now, one function of entering a building like this with a magnificent kind of entrance device is it really helps turn ordinary buildings and places into and spots into what we can articulate as special places. It's one of those elements architecturally of placemaking. As I was saying before, we have numerous examples of buildings that are, you don't know where the front door is. How do you get in it? That's sometimes exploited in another way and made into a fun engagement of the person. in this case, a dormitory complex at Yale where you walk between all the towers. This is actually an American simulation of an Italian hill town, where you walk on the paths in the hill town until you find where the entrances are to the building. You go through tunnels and you walk around, and you finally find them. But you're, and it's okay because you're really having a good time getting there, except when it's really raining. Another example is of the way entrances can be described and have a lot of messages that go along with them, or perhaps too, is of kind of fortress symbolism, is by describing a long sequence of path that you have to go through. You go through one arch, and then through a gate, and then another arch, and you move from an outside court into an inside court. You say a lot of things to people. At the same time, you're saying that once you get there, you're in a special place. You may be alerting someone that, well, you better really, you know, kind of check your ID, because somebody's going to, you know, in a sense, symbolically ask you if you're allowed in here. Or it may be a fortress-like image that goes along with it. In this case, another example at Yale, it's a lot of delight going through a place like this, because your senses are filled with different textures, and you look up and you see towers, and you look at windows, and you eventually arrive at a doorway. Here's an example where the process of getting through a wall, and a very fat one, is quite an event. Of going from one side of the wall to the other, and when you're in the other place, you know you've really arrived there. There are other examples of this that I won't dwell on. And we have to think very carefully about entrances, because at the same time we love kind of the magnificence of gates and portals and devices that we know from history. The whole idea of accessibility, of friendliness of a place, can relate a whole lot to simply the way these entrances are formed. Another example of a more modern building in a historic context is a library in which you walk under part of the building. It's all glass like this, and you have to kind of walk around the whole building, unless you've been there before, to figure out where the front door is. This is an example of mannerism. This is one of the buildings that helped a few hotshot designers in the country. This was shown in a lot of slide lectures on the East Coast in the 1960s as an example of how you take a form and a walkway going up to their front door, and the pillar was in the way. Couldn't tell where to get in. Well, you cut off the guy, right? And then it clears everything up. Right? It's and of course, you know where you go in now, right? Okay. And you would, and in a way, it looks kind of absurd at one level of expectation, but it, in a way, is actually a very excellent way to suggest to people on an old form how it can greet people. Frank Lloyd Wright's Unity Temple in Chicago has a sign on the front of what the sermon is and who's there. And this is what you see from the street. And of course you can find your way in, because the idea is that you need to explore around the edges until you find the door. But at first, this is a kind of a forbidding, I think, image to be presenting the public. The opposite of that, in Mies van der Rohe's chapel at ITT, which has been affectionately in the past called the God Box. because it's a minimalist statement of, you know, high-tech 1950s design, where the detailing and the geometry of the building is the message. There's almost no effort spent getting in here. You know, it's like there's almost no difference between the outside and the inside going through it. It's almost, you, and you actually, when you walk in there, you're frankly disappointed because you open the door and, well, I'm here. But there's no here. There isn't any place. Okay. And so devices have been invented over the years in many kinds of modern building to amplify entrance, to make a statement out of entrance. In Marcel Breuer's St. John's Abbey in Minnesota, he designed a wonderful worship space, and there's a baptistry kind of entrance, which is this low building that's skylighted. But in a way, there was not a way to get into this building satisfactorily with the way the original plan was set up. And fortunately, he was inventive and decided, well, a historic church would have what on the west entrance? Like the cathedrals we saw, it would have had towers, and it would have had big tympanums over arched doorways to let people know where to go in. So instead of having a towers and those historic things, he invented a device out of solid concrete called a bell banner, which is like a campanile. It has some human imagery. It's kind of like walking between the legs of something to get into the front door. It also can be seen from about 15 miles away, I think. It, so it really makes quite a statement on the landscape. And it's interesting to look at because the entrance device then is really helping you find where to go into the space, but it's trying to say something to the public about the building. So that is one of the messages, first of all, of any place, is it says something to the outside world. Onion skin domes have an incredible impact, I'm sure, on that skyline, being out of gold and being tipped with crosses. And I guess over all the years of the Soviet Socialist Republic, I don't think any of those crosses were taken off. They were left on there. That verticality that I was complaining about in church building, in a sense, has had a really useful function in the past because you could make the church the biggest object in town. Yeah, starting with even Charlemagne's chapel in Belgium, which was at the time the tallest thing there. Now, we've all seen pictures of what happens now with churches next to Wall Street. Right? The church just is not the big image in town, right? It just isn't anymore. And so, in a way, going up in the air does not have the same statement that Marcel Breuer could make out on the plains of Minnesota or that Charlemagne could make downtown Brussels. Not Brussels, excuse me. The statement of St. Peter's in Rome from the Renaissance was a big dome space. We did not pick up on this communication device very much, except in many Roman Catholic churches because of the association with this. But as we all know, this has tended to be another image in our society, which is what?
Government.
Right. Washington Cathedral, National Cathedral in Washington, is of course a Gothic image on the hill. A typical cathedral plan was also in a cross, which I think is of interest for many reasons. And here again is the fish. That external image, I don't think is very readable. It's a nice, maybe a nice concept in somebody's head, but it wasn't. Similarly, Michelangelo, when he devised the second version of St. Peter's in Rome, in the 16th century, really was making a very tight geometric shape that was like an Eastern mandala. And it had its own properties, its own geometry that was thought to have had special qualities. But I think when you walk through the space, you don't have a sense of that, nor does really the community at large, I think, read that kind of symbolism. Le Corbusier's Notre Dame du Haut in Ronchamp is a famous pilgrimage church that many of you have seen slides of. Probably one of the most artistically sensitive modern churches of the century, in which this plastic form up on a hill is approached by a trip up the hill, then you arrive at this piece of art, and it kind of scoops you in toward the entrance. The roof form is very magical because it is suspended on a little band of window about 6 inches high on the top of the walls. This is the guy who invented that, if you see it in other churches. A roof suspended over glass, so it just floats. Don't have pictures of the inside. A very interesting funnel shape that drew you in. I'm showing this because one thing he exploited from other eras in this building is the wall that sweeps over in the bottom of the picture to the right, which you can see in the here with all these little punctuations, is the stained glass window wall. On the outside, it has all these clever little articulations of window, but not so much that it destroys the shape of the wall. That was the intention. When you get on the inside, each one of those is magnified like fourfold, so that you have a feeling on the inside that the wall is almost all window. Very, very creative kind of church. Very little to talk about in terms of the liturgical space. It's basically a medieval plan internally. And on the back side of the church, for gatherings of thousands, this actually functions as the backdrop on the hillside for outdoor church services. They can't drive up there, so fortunately it's not set up as a drive-in church. Okay. So here again, we have clear statements made about from the outsides of buildings. And I wanted to emphasize again that part of what we, I think, enjoy seeing that contributes to a sense of place is the way a space is formed. We talked about authenticity of materials at the last session. I think that when a space like this Christ Church in Virginia, an old historic church, is built with such simplicity of material usage, we tend to relate to that. We also, I think, are interested in orderliness, in placemaking, so that a place has that special quality that we would call a place. In Hagia Sophia, again, there's a very tight geometry that controls this place, although it has kind of a wild interplay of light and form. Order vertically, order and plan. Even Le Corbusier's church had an understandable order about it. We also are interested in a dimension that we learn, I think, from Gestalt psychology in the fact that our senses pick up on all of these ingredients at one time. And in fact, accelerate our awareness of the whole picture to the extent that you couldn't analyze all of the individual components independently and arrive at the same awareness. This kind of goes under the title of holistic thinking many times, but in terms of studies of perception of paintings and of places, really the totality adds up to more than the sum of the parts in the way we perceive environments. An illustration that I could use from my other work in historic preservation is that in historic districts and towns, and the way our towns are laid out, we sometimes think that what is important is the individual kind of star building, an individual landmark. But for instance, in this streetscape from Northfield, where we live, you can have along this row of buildings a rather insignificant building that, if it were missing, something would be missing from the street, the streetscape itself. Even though that building has not contributed a whole lot in terms of its own style, by the fact that it's there and it's following the pattern and the order of the street, makes that street environment really much more interesting and much more vital. I call that the missing tooth phenomenon. If you have a building missing from a lineup, you really notice that kind of the whole streetscape suffers from it. I don't have time to go into this particular project, although I might just mention that when we don't authentically try to deal with what is our material in front of us, we get into real problems. Here was a designer who was trying to solve two problems at one time. He wanted to have a rain cover for an entrance to a high school building. At the same time, they built an extension of that building across a main highway. And so they built a gerbil tube connecting these two buildings that, in logical terms, seemed to fill the bill. But I think aesthetically, in terms of the gestalt impact, it's done some disastrous things to this building. It does not look satisfactory to most people's eyes. Although, if you analyze this piece by piece, it would seem to make sense. I think we're interested in materials that used in buildings that are not anything but what they are. Offended when I go into McDonald's restaurants. I guess I shouldn't admit that I go into McDonald's restaurants. I will. Where the quarry tile is designed to look like wood texture. Right? Most of us designers try to keep away from formica that looks like walnut and oak and things of that sort. I have a running argument with our school system administration because everyone wants to have fake looking materials in classrooms because they like them. And I keep saying, isn't this a place of truth?
No.
Aren't we dealing with truth in school? Vail, Colorado deals with our senses in a way that is delightful and is interesting, but it's not Switzerland. Can you say that it's phony? Or is that not the right thing to say? This example that I showed you the other time, the question comes up, well, are there enough clues here to really know whether or not what you see is what you've got? Disney World. Main Street is not a real Main Street. It's delightful, it's fun, and it's playful. And if I had more time, I could describe you how it works aesthetically, and it is fun to experience. But it is not the same kind of streetscape as Northfield, Minnesota, or downtown Chelan, or whatever, because it is phony and it's using some illusionistic tricks to make you buy that it's real. So I think all in all, I'm going to have to stop at this point because we've run out of time. The point being that all of these ingredients that add up to make a place are in so many ways elusive, except that it can be said that what we understand about the way our senses perceive things, we really take in all of these features all at one time. And I might add that in terms of the word place, what kind of place this is, you might think about what are those special locations on earth that you are aware of that you give special names or that you enjoy being in for the sake of being in them, and think about the qualities that those particular places have that lend to that whole system of that you apprehend. You might think, well, I did this last May to an Elderhalster group, was where is the nicest, most enjoyable place to be right here at Hilden when you're as an occupant here? You might think about that individually and try to analyze how your senses perceive a place in all of its dimensions toward that end.